Ms. Angus, can we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Your Honor. Deputy Attorney General Regina M. Oberholzer on behalf of the state.
Good morning, Your Honor. Michael Jeffrey Evangold.
Jeffrey Evangold representing the New Jersey State Bar Association.
Deputy Your Honor, Michael Arnovich.
Good afternoon, counsel. Please be seated. Welcome. In the interest of time and to help provide some guidance, we'd ask that you focus on areas where there is disagreement with the special master's report. Ms. Oberholzer.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, I'd like to reserve a few minutes for rebuttal.
Yes.
And Mr. Chief Justice, as you've recognized, there are many areas where we agree. I won't catalog them, I was going to, but I obviously you've read our briefs and our reply briefs, and you know that most areas we disagree on. There are two main areas where we disagree. The first is the proper procedure for seeking relief if a defendant is a Dennis affected defendant, and he is seeking, he is facing an enhanced sentence as a repeat offender at a second DWI. And the state and Amici agree that the proper procedure is a PCR in the original jurisdiction. Despite that agreement, there seems to be a sense that Mr. Zingas, who did not follow that procedure, should nonetheless be sentenced as a first offender, even though he did not file a PCR in Collingswood. And in fact, all the documentation both at his first sentence and his second sentencing and at the special master's hearing establishes that he was not a Dennis affected defendant. The second area of disagreement is the proper level of access to a document referred to throughout the proceedings as S-152. That document is a Excel spreadsheet that includes all the Alcatest subject test records from every breathalyzer test, Alcatest given during the entire 8.5 year period that Alcatest machines calibrated by former Sergeant Dennis were in use throughout the state, regardless of who calibrated those machines. The special master recommended that that spreadsheet in conjunction with calibration records of machines calibrated by Dennis be used to determine whether a defendant with a prior conviction for DWI was in fact a Dennis affected defendant. And I believe all parties agree that that's the proper procedure, but the state feels very strongly that access to that list needs to be strictly limited to as few people as possible because there are 236,000 test records on that list, a large number of them not Dennis affected, the majority of them, and a very large number of them of individuals who were never convicted of a crime. That listing includes not just names, but personal identifying information. And based on that, when this court ordered that the Alcatest identification system from which that spreadsheet was created be set up, this court ordered that that personal identifying information, including names, be redacted so that there would not be access to that information. So those are the two areas on which we are mostly in disagreement. And I'm happy to take questions from the court on whichever one the court would like to address first.
Thank you. Let's start with the first one and try to clarify for us, if you would, the nature of the process as you see it. An individual is arrested on a DWI, and that person has a prior conviction for a DWI. Can the defendant file PCR after the second arrest?
Yes.
And in which court, municipal, law division, does it matter whether there was an appeal? There was a trial de novo in the law division on the prior conviction. Where do they file?
So it would be in whichever court the conviction arose, probably in the municipal court. The municipal court rules actually specifically provide for a PCR to be filed in the municipal court where the conviction arose if a defendant is facing an enhanced sentence based on that. In Cassidy, this court specifically relaxed the 5-year time limit for doing so in these Dennis cases. So if a defendant doesn't learn that he's a Dennis defendant until he's facing an enhanced sentence based on that conviction, that's not a bar to him doing so at that stage.
And then in this,
go ahead.
I'm sorry. And then in the second, I have a bunch of questions on this, and you're helping us.
It's complicated.
The second case, is it put on hold as to sentencing until the outcome of the PCR matter in the other court
yes.
is resolved?
Yes. That was also addressed in Cassidy.
Does the individual get assigned counsel if they can't afford counsel for the PCR as to the first conviction?
I don't believe that was addressed, but I would think so.
Why not proceed in the ongoing second court case? I'm trying to figure out what is the most sensible way for this to take place. Why have two proceedings in front of two judges instead of one consolidated proceeding?
Well, the records are most likely, to the extent they exist, are most likely to exist in the first court of jurisdiction.
Right, but they can easily be understood by judges who handle these kinds of matters, regardless of where they arise.
Right. But the these aren't simple, straightforward, was it a Dennis case or not a Dennis case. In the 1,200 or so.
Sorry, that was my question, actually. So can I ask that? Are you suggesting that the defendant has to file a PCR to figure out if it was a Dennis case or not? Or I thought you had actually come to the position that the second judge in the second matter upon which the person could receive the enhanced sentence can preside over the discovery process such that the defendant finds out whether they actually, whether the original conviction was based on a calibration from a Dennis calibrate, sorry, was based on a BAC reading from an instrument that had been calibrated by Sergeant Dennis. And the PCR would not be necessary to figure out, is it a Dennis case or not? It would only be necessary if it is a Dennis case, and the defendant then wants to move to have that conviction vacated because it is a BAC level that originated from a Dennis calibrated machine.
Right. So there are two questions. Was the BAC in the first case a Dennis case? So if the person was tested on an Alka-Test machine that resulted in an evidential BAC, so actually ended up with a BAC result, and a person will be on that list even if the BAC is zero, and they could be convicted with a zero BAC if they were convicted of drugs, for example. So they would have had a DRE. So somebody could have a BAC of zero and still be convicted of DWI if they were under the influence of narcotics. In that case, the fact that they had a BAC on a Dennis calibrated machine is not actually going to have affected the outcome of their conviction. They could also, in many of these cases, the BAC results may have been suppressed for some reason. My understanding is that in something like a third of these PCRs that have been litigated so far, the BAC results did not come in.
Not come in originally, you mean?
Right. And so about 1,200 of these cases were litigated in consolidated proceedings in the five main counties where Dennis was calibrating these machines. And in about a third of them, my understanding is the BAC results never actually came in. And so in those PCRs, those defendants didn't get relief because the BAC results didn't affect the outcome of the proceedings. So the question,
are you suggesting... Do they have to file PCR to find out if they are a Dennis case? Okay.
No. So what we suggest is that in the first instance, if somebody is facing an enhanced sentence as a result of a prior DWI that occurred during that 8.5 year time frame, the S-152 would be checked to determine the Alka-Test serial number. And then that would be cross-referenced against the calibration repository to see if Sergeant Dennis calibrated that machine at that time. If so, that information and the calibration records would be provided to the defense. They could then seek a stay and file a PCR if they wanted to. I would think they would, but they may know that the Alka-Test results weren't admitted, and then they would know that they didn't have any reason to. They could seek a PCR in the court where the conviction was entered. and challenge that conviction.
You said there are two questions, and you went through.
So that's the second. So that's the second stage, is to file the PCR. So first, that there's a determination in the sentencing court as to whether they were a defendant, a Dennis defendant. And then the second step is, if they are, they can file a PCR.
Oh, hypothetically, you were arrested in New Brunswick on a DWI. It's your second arrest. You have a prior conviction also in New Brunswick. You show up in New Brunswick Municipal Court on the second case, and the judge then, at some point, sends you down the hall to another judge in New Brunswick to handle the PCR, after which it comes back to the first courtroom. Why is that? Is that the most sensible approach? Or perhaps another way to ask the question is, would the state or the defense be harmed if we had a consolidated proceeding? And if so, how?
Well, even after the PCR is granted, the state still has the option of charging again, re-proceeding. They don't have to dismiss those charges. They can still seek a observation only conviction. There's still the option of pleading that down.
This court relaxed
with regard to the first. This court relaxed the restriction on guilty pleas and DWIs in the Dennis cases, and the legislature has just passed an amendment allowing for guilty pleas negotiations in DWIs as well. So there could be still be a conviction on that. Ultimately, so there could be a consolidated proceeding, I suppose, in the same jurisdiction, but it would have to allow for the state to still seek a conviction before sentencing
appropriate proceedings in both courts. I'm asking with an eye toward efficiency in light of the volume of cases that we face. Is either side harmed by a consolidated proceeding that would allow what would take place in the bifurcated court rooms to take place in just one?
As long as the state is still allowed to seek, is given time to get the records from the other jurisdiction. I mean, if we're dealing with two counties, not just two municipalities in the same county, but two counties.
Of course.
And, has time to get that information. And the municipality of the original jurisdiction is given the opportunity to pursue re-prosecuting that case before a sentencing decision is made. And that's a primary concern, is if
you're thinking prosecutor one may not want to travel.
Well, prosecutor one may not want to want a different jurisdiction making the decision and what happens in that case, or may not want a judge in another county making the decision about whether to accept that guilty
plea. Why should that matter?
I don't know. I mean, we could, as long as it's not a question of the judge in the sentencing court saying you're a Dennis defendant, the BAC should have been thrown out, we're throwing it out and we're sentencing you as a first offender, which is essentially what the appellate division did here.
But a court could come to that conclusion. A municipal judge could reach that decision.
But if a judge reaches that decision, the prosecutor, the municipal prosecutor, still has the option of pursuing the charges again.
Of course, without the BAC.
Right. But if the sentencing judge makes that decision and imposes sentence as a first offender without giving the municipal prosecutor the option, that's what we're concerned about.
You're talking, by the way, about guilty plea cases, not about trials that were based on a BAC, which is now thrown out, or are you covering?
Well, either. If the charges are thrown out, the prosecutor still has the option of retrying the case.
So help me, I may be off base and you'll correct me. You're charged with a crime. The state is given its burden to come forward. The prosecution comes forward with its case and it loses. It bases its case entirely on the BAC. Can it then come back and say, Judge, now I want to do it based on the observational evidence. I want a second trial without running into double jeopardy issues?
An after discovered evidence case?
In this case, wouldn't the prosecution have won, not lost the first time? Because if the prosecution lost the first time and the person wasn't convicted of anything, the person is just acquitted, then they're never going to be sentenced as a second offender. It's that the prosecution won.
We won.
Then a court decided that a piece of the evidence that went into the prosecution's win was inadmissible.
Right.
And so can the prosecution then try the person again without that inadmissible evidence?
Yes.
Really? So let's make it simpler. You have, forget about Dennis. You have a trial. Takes place in municipal court one, and state puts in all the evidence that it chooses to put in, and the appellate division says reversed. Does it get to have a second trial on entirely different evidence that it selected not to proceed with?
If the court found that the evidence that we presented was insufficient, we would not be able to proceed. But if the court found that some of our evidence should have been suppressed, this court would remand for a new trial without the suppressed evidence.
Or if the court found there had been a Brady violation or anything like that, you would just remand for a new trial without
the inadmissible evidence.
If your whole case is based on a BAC, let's imagine this world is condensed, and for some reason the BAC is thrown out. You get to go back and retry the case on observational evidence? Pre-Dennis.
We don't know that there wasn't. I mean, some of these cases may have had observational evidence. We don't know.
Yes, but the state didn't present that. My question is on double jeopardy grounds. Can you try a case under this set of evidence? And then if it's tossed for whatever reason, the BAC was flawed. You can try the case on an entirely different ground the second time?
We can try the case with whatever evidence we have available. And in some of these cases, both observational and BAC evidence may have been admitted. That's one of the things I'm saying, is we don't know what other evidence may have been admitted. But
are you saying it's the equivalent of the appellate division's disposition of a criminal matter by reversing the conviction and sending the case back for a new trial?
Right.
Which would not ordinarily.
I don't think we'd be limited in what evidence we could introduce. I mean, if we had come across other new evidence in the meantime, I think we'd be allowed to admit that as well. But.
And anyway.
But I think that as long as the state's ability to make that decision. And I mean, the reality is most of these cases are very old. We're at 8 years.
Doesn't that require a lot of careful attention to the actual nature of the disposition on appeal of the Dennis related case? In other words, is it dismissed or is it vacated or reversed and then remanded, which would not typically violate double jeopardy?
It should be vacated and reversed, as in any other case where a piece of evidence is no longer admissible. But the decision needs to be made as to whether that piece of evidence affected the outcome of the trial, which is not always going to be the case. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, it just seems to me that if there could be dispositions that would cause double jeopardy issues, if the state said, okay, we're going back and retrying this person.
Double jeopardy issues are mostly going to arise where there's been an acquittal, and those aren't obviously going to be.
Certainly if there's an acquittal, but.
I steered us down this road. Let's come back to the roadway that we should be on for the moment.
Okay, so.
Could you give us your final position on whether or not the matters could all be resolved in one court, just to button that up?
Again, as they could be if the state were given the opportunity to pursue, to make a determination as to whether they had the option to pursue the charges in some format after a determination before sentencing on the subsequent.
They always will, right? It's a prosecutor's decision whether or not to proceed with a case unless the court finds a legal basis to dismiss it.
Right. But as I said, that's not what happened here. The appellate division determined that we hadn't proven beyond a reasonable doubt that that Mr. Zingas was not a Dennis defendant and ordered that he be sentenced as a first offender.
And is that, are you saying that's not the right standard?
Well, it's not the right standard. Even proving the existence of a prior conviction only needs to be proven by a preponderance of the evidence. If there had been a PCR hearing, the state concedes that even though normally in PCR hearings, the burden is on the defense, given the unique circumstances of these cases and the fact that there was malfeasance by a state employee, that the burden in these cases is on the state to establish that the Dennis's actions didn't adversely affect the defense. But that's at a PCR hearing.
But I'm going to need you to state that again, though. In terms of the enhanced sentencing, whose burden is that to prove before a judge can sentence somebody to an enhanced sentence?
It's the state's burden to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that the defendant has a prior conviction.
Where is that stated? What's your source of that?
State versus Oliver, which is 162 NJ 580, interpreted 2C1-13D2's language that the prior conviction needs to be proven to the satisfaction of the court, as requiring prior convictions in the context of three strike laws need only be proven by a preponderance of the evidence.
What was that statute citation?
2C:1-13D2. And that's not the three strikes law. That's just the general burdens.
So on the question of which court, it would be helpful to hear from all counsel on this, and we might benefit from the AOC's input as well.
Yes.
My main question is there a harm? And I haven't heard one articulated yet.
No, I mean, when Cassidy first came out, this court consolidated all of these cases in the five primary counties, with the exception of the handful of cases in the adjacent counties. And at some point, Judge Fall determined that that was no longer necessary and the cases could be tried back in the counties of original jurisdiction because there were simply not that many of them arising anymore. And I don't know that determination has lost its teeth. He recommended that they be tried in their courts, their counties of original.
I appreciate this would be a new process. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm asking, how would it hurt the state? How would it hurt the defense?
I don't know that there's any reason they can't be consolidated in the counties in the same court. But I would say if the court is going to impose a different burden or change the standard for sentencing, what the state needs to prove at sentencing for a second, you know, for using a conviction as an enhancement and basically impose a PCR burden at sentencing to prove the validity of the prior conviction, that that if the court finds that we did not do so in Mr. Zingas's case, that we'd be allowed to do so on remand.
The suggestion is that all the legal principles would be the same. As if this were a bifurcated proceeding.
Okay.
And you would still, just to make sure, you would still want to be able to have two off-ramps. One, that PCR is not always granted, correct? Because in some cases you said PCR was not granted because it turns out the BAC level was zero, or the BAC level had not been actually admitted in the trial. Or that if PCR is granted, that you could then retry without whichever evidence was inadmissible being admitted.
Right. And of course, the off-ramp of they were born a Dennis defendant in the first place, which is the fact in Mr. Zingas's case.
Correct. But you said they wouldn't have to file PCR to figure that
right.
out.
You are stipulating
they could figure that out without filing for PCR. So they
Absolutely.
Only have to file for PCR if they know that they are a Dennis defendant because of checking S-152 and the Dennis repository.
Right. And if the court wanted something in writing to that, because right now there's not really any, if someone's not a Dennis defendant, there's not really a document that says that. You get a page from an Excel spreadsheet that has 25 other names on it. And, you know, the municipal prosecutor liaison for the county could very easily do a form letter that said, we searched the, you know, S-152 and so-and-so was tested on this date, on this Alka-Test number with this serial number. It was calibrated by coordinator ex.
Coordinator, so, not Dennis. Not
yeah,
Dennis.
Coordinator Dennis, or we would give the coordinator's name and, you know, and, or it was Dennis on such and such a date. And, you know, we would do the same four letter regardless if it was. And then if it was Dennis, obviously we would provide the coordination.
When you say they get 25 names, is it alphabetical and it's just showing that person's not?
It's actually, well, it's an Excel spreadsheet, so it can be sorted any way you want. But in its current form, the way it was provided to the court in the online index that was provided to the court and just as a an electronic attachment to the special master's report, it's actually sorted alphabetically by serial number of the Alka-Test machines.
Well, one more question with respect to the second trial, if there needed to be one. Do the charging documents in these cases usually list a BAC level, if that's the basis? Or is it a more generalized description of the crime in your experience?
I don't know.
Of the offense?
I don't know.
Okay. Other questions on the first point? You want to move on to the exhibit?
Yeah. And actually, my last point is sort of my first point. A search, you know, allowing anybody who thinks they might have been a Dennis affected defendant to search S-152 under a protective order. You're talking about anybody who thinks they were maybe arrested for DWI, or their client was maybe arrested for DWI in that 8.5 year time period. Because they may be wrong about the time period. They may be off by 6 months or a year. They're going to pull up, even if they just look at the page their name comes up on, they're looking at maybe 25 to 40 or more names, depending on the size of their screen. I have two screens. I got 25 lines on one screen and 40 pages on the next, and I don't have giant screens. Not just their own name, and assuming they don't have a name that comes up, you know, their name's not Smith, that comes up 15 times and they have to look at each one. It's not like searching for your name in a database and you only get your page result, like searching in the municipal court records for your abstract. You're getting the names of, you know, because it's pulling up the results by Alka-Test machine, it's the people who were tested in the municipality where you were stopped at the time you were stopped. Very likely your friends and neighbors, your kids, kindergarten teacher, the local librarian, the person who's running for mayor next week. No information as to whether they were acquitted. And it's kind of hard to unsee. You know, we may be able, when we provide it, if we were to provide a printout of it, to take a black marker and black out every line but the relevant one. But if somebody's searching for themselves, best intentions notwithstanding, they're going to see a lot of names they know, because it's the Alka-Test machine more often than not for their local municipal police department. And that's a lot of people who's, you know,
Is it practical to do what is sometimes done in civil litigation, and that is have an attorney's eyes only protective order?
We're again talking about attorneys for theoretically tens or hundreds of thousands of people. It's a lot of eyes on a database that, on an Excel spreadsheet that was created from a database containing personal identifying information from people that we already know many of them we can't find addresses for, to notify them that their information is going to be looked at by many, many people. And this court has already indicated concern for that information being seen by too many people by ordering that that information be redacted from the public-facing database in Chun. And to the extent that the state itself has a concern about that, we are not allowing all the prosecutors to see it. We have one designated person in each county who checks the list for the municipal prosecutors. We have a liaison in each county. We have a very small office in the Attorney General's office that can check it. And I believe there is one person in state police who has the authority to search the Alka-Test information system in a way that they can produce S-152 or other of the spreadsheets in this case that would show names.
Is that an Excel document also?
S-152 is an Excel document. But, you know, right now, as far as people the state has given access to that are under our authority, there are about 25 of us. It's not something we're disseminating widely. When the AOC created a much smaller list and disseminated it to municipal courts, they also directed that it not be released because of concern about the personal identifying information. So it's not just names or addresses, it's driver's license numbers, dates of birth, information that can be used to steal people's identities, and also other information you might not want your neighbors accidentally seeing about you, like your weight. And, you know, it's just a lot of information in addition to the fact that you were arrested for a crime you might not even have been convicted of.
Is there any alternative to getting at that information in a way that doesn't raise those concerns?
Well, if an attorney doesn't trust the information provided by the state, they can ask the AOC, who has a copy of the list, to confirm it.
When you say the information provided by the state, so you're agreeing that you would provide the line from S-152 that has the client's name?
We could do that. It would be, unfortunately, the line is 30 columns long, so it's cumbersome. It would be easier to provide a signed letter from the municipal prosecutor liaison in the county, providing the relevant information from that, the name of the coordinator, the date of the test, the municipality, and the serial number, which then could be used to cross-check the AIS. That's one search, one $5 search. It can be cross-checked. You can call up the municipal court, the AOC, or whoever in the courts have access to the list and ask them to double-check it. It wouldn't have to be something that would have to be widely available to anybody who called up and represented to the court that they had a reason to have the list.
Somebody's name, and there's a dentist-related calibration on the AIS. They don't have to look at a second document, do they? They know they have the information they need in order to try to affect the sentence for the current.
Well, their names are not on the AIS.
Names are not on the AIS.
Names are not on the AIS. It's one of the things this court ordered redacted.
Right.
That's why they need the info from S1.
That's why they need, there needs to be another document.
But
and this is the document.
You are agreeing to provide that for the one individual, just not for all 236,000 people.
Right. I mean, this is the document that the special master decided was the most reliable to make sure nobody was falling through the cracks, that no, you know, there weren't. If we try and create a list of people we know are dentist defendants.
Can people use the AIS with independently as and to find out, yes, the prior offense, lawyer, client, self-represented person, whatever it may be, the prior offense was in fact a dentist-related calibration. Therefore, I've got what I need.
You can if you have the right information.
Okay.
Which you can gather from.
But what I'm suggesting is, would that reduce the number of people who would have to look at the S-152 document?
Yes, but if they have access to S-152, they're going to use S-152 because it's easier and it doesn't cost $5 a search.
And you're not willing to allow either municipal prosecutors or defense attorneys access to it in a controlled space of any kind? For example, like the municipal prosecutor's office.
The difficulty with that is they're still not just seeing one name on the list. It's not like running a search through the municipal court database for the name. Because when you search for the name, you get a whole list of names. So you're not protecting the personal information of everybody else on that page. If somebody had a special need, you know, if they petitioned the court and had a special need, could present a reason. There's been a lot of speculation about what that reason might be. Nobody's come up with one that convinces me yet. But if somebody came up with a need that was unique, that they could convince a trial court that they needed access to the list, there could certainly be exceptions to that. But given the way the list is compiled and the amount of information on that list, I just have concerns about the number of people who are on that list who don't know that that information is being put out there to people who may have reason to see one person's name on the list, but don't have reason to see all the other names on the list.
Anyone on that list who's been charged with a DUI, that information exists publicly.
Yes, but you have to know how to search for it. You're not going to accidentally come across it searching for somebody else's name, and you're not going to get some of the other information that's on there.
And some people weren't charged with a DUI ever, correct, on the list?
Or possibly not. And you've been arrested, but you may not necessarily have been formally charged if you come back with a zero BAC and there aren't indications of, you know, drug use as well or whatever ever. And there's certainly a lot of people who were acquitted, a large number of people on the list, based on the list of Just Dennis defendants that the AOC then ran. The acquittal rate was something like 32% from that list. So it's a large number of people who, and that information is nowhere on S-152 or in the AIS. So
is there any reason to be concerned about attorneys or municipal prosecutors to misuse that information? Is there any genuine basis to fear that?
It's not that they'll, you know, go out and publicize it, but it's a lot of people, and a lot because of the number of people who may have reason to access the list. It's a lot of people's eyes on personal information that's supposed to be kept private. And when that many people are seeing it, the privacy ordered by this court in Chun becomes elusive. Even if, you know, 1% of the people on the list want to look at it, that's still 2,000 people seeing that, you know, my next door neighbor was arrested for DWI.
I may be overconfident in technology, but what prevents that S-152 in its current format from being revised so that someone could put in a name and get only the name? I mean, obviously, a lot of work would be involved. But you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I have no idea.
If AI can change the world, why couldn't
that would certainly alleviate a lot of concerns. The list as it currently exists is not something we'd be comfortable having.
It does seem like, given that it's in an Excel spreadsheet with specific categories, that a database could be generated from that Excel spreadsheet, because all of the necessary information and pertinent information is already categorized. So that's not something that would need to be redone. Do you think it's cost prohibitive to create such a database that would allow someone to search specifically for their name, similar to how they would search municipal court records and only get their name?
I would have no, you know, that wasn't explored at all in front of the special master, so there was no discussion about the costs. I there was concern. I know that this was all gleaned from the AIS, which is a database that is maintained by the search fee, but of course this information, they can't be searched by name, and that is one of the downfalls for
in its current
our purposes.
Status.
It can't be searched by name, and because it's public facing, we don't want it to be. This court ordered that it not be searched by name, and for valid reasons. But
I understand it doesn't resolve all issues because somebody could search their name. I'm done with my name, but I'd like to check out all of my neighbors and the six people up here that I work with, and everybody in this audience. It could be.
And the problem is once you search by name, what you get, unlike when you search the municipal court, like the eCourts website, which is a publicly searchable website, at least when you search there, you see the results. You see that it was an acquittal or a guilt or, you know, which is, and you don't get driver's license number, I don't believe, on that page.
Could the spreadsheet be revised with technology that is beyond my skill to redact all but the 20,000 or so names out of the 236,000?
Well, that's what we started with. And through human error or computer error, it was not a completely accurate list. So there were 436 people who shouldn't have been, or not people, they're subject test records. So some people were tested two or three times because of errors with machines, and they had to be tested more than once. And there were 29 subject test records that were omitted, which were actually only 23 people. So which out of 20,000 isn't bad, but it was both over-inclusive and under-inclusive. And that's why the special master recommended this, so that there would be no question that if your name didn't appear there, you just didn't have an ALCA test. So, and then you know if you're Dennis or you're not Dennis. You get a definitive yes or no. This is the ALCA test machine you were tested on. This is the date. We can check the calibration records and find out who, did Dennis calibrate your machine or not?
Your point is that the Donahue document, in theory, originally was S-152, but only with the Dennis calibrated people. But then the special master found that there were certain errors on it.
Yeah, S-90. And so that's why he's not recommending using that with the amendments of taking out the ones that didn't belong there and adding the ones that do. So we could go back to using that document. That was the state's original proposal, but we don't object to this one as long as it's not.
So as I understood the special master's report, he was ordering disclosure of the Dennis calibration repository and S-152. Can S-152 be redacted and disclosed along with the repository to address the concerns?
So the problem is once we redact S-152, it's no more useful than the AIS, except that it's free to search. Once we redact the information we're concerned about, it isn't a useful search tool.
Someone couldn't search for their names because you would take out all the names.
Couldn't search for their name if they have a common name. They couldn't compare their driver's license number, date of birth, the information you need to make sure that this Joe Smith is you and not the Joe Smith who lives in the next county over or whatever.
Couldn't you do it by a date range of the dates where somebody was arrested and then with that limited information, get the state to then verify which one is accurate, if at all? Because then you're just finding the dates where somebody suggests they're arrested. I know there's a 1 day or 2 day window on either side, depending on either human error or just time changing from day to night. But then somebody can say, okay, these are the dates I was arrested from S-152. My dates are here. And then if you look at the AIS to find the right calibration report is there as well. And now the state can verify, is this me or not? So now the names don't have to be revealed. And there's some additional mechanism where the person can search on their own and be able to say definitively, I've seen that there's an entry in here that might be mine.
Oh, so look without the names.
Correct.
The problem is a lot of people don't know where they were tested.
Or when even, probably.
And a lot of times, you're talking about cases that go back to 2008, 2016. So a lot of people aren't really sure of the exact.
But this all begins because the state is saying, you need to be enhanced because of an arrest that took place
on such and such date,
a sentence that will happen as a result.
Right, but we do know where they were arrested, but where they were arrested isn't necessarily where they were tested. But
the date's going to be there.
The date should be there.
Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add at this point?
Just one sort of tangential point. The special master issued a protective order presenting the dissemination of the personal identifying information of litigants, counsel, and potentially affected defendants in this case. The order is unclear as to the terms of its expiration and not entirely clear that potentially affected defendants included everybody in S-152 rather than just Dennis defendants. So I would just respectfully request that the court issue an order extending the protective order until this court determines the level of access to that information and make it clear that it covers everybody in S-152.
And ask
that you reverse the order of the appellate division, reinstate defendant's sentence as a second offender, and adopt the recommendations of the special master with modifications to protect the personal identifying information of the 236,000 plus people in S-152 and set a procedure to clarify that PCR is the proper means of seeking relief in these cases, in the Dennis cases.
Thank you, Counsel.